Morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Thompson. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Captain Tiffany Dewitt, along with Colonel Mark Delatosha. We represent the appellant, Private Christine Thompson, in this matter. The government violated its mandate under Article 10 to take immediate steps to bring an accused to trial when it took the government 145 days to bring Private Christine Thompson to trial for an offense which was something less than an ordinary street crime. 145 days during which Private Christine Thompson languished in an isolation cell in Bell County, Texas.
Are we talking about 145 days here, or are we talking about basically about 6 weeks?
Your Honor, we're talking about the 445 days. If you exclude the 39 days from defense delay, it's still 106 delays.
Well, but didn't the military judge focus on one rather small portion of that?
Yes, Your Honor, and I would clarify that the appellant agrees with the military judge that those 37 days are egregious enough, where there's no prosecutorial activity, are egregious enough to substantiate an Article 10 violation, but disagrees with the military judge's ultimate conclusion that the remaining time outside of those 37 days, the government was acting with reasonable diligence.
So do you want to go through the judge's findings then and conclusions and tell us where the judges got it wrong on those other days?
Regarding the appellant doesn't disagree with any of the findings of fact. However, the appellant would disagree that 5 weeks to prefer additional charges is reasonable. Would disagree that a month to process a Chapter 10 request is reasonable. Would disagree that taking 2 weeks to serve a copy of the Article 32 report after it's been completed is reasonable. All of those periods of all those instances show that the government wasn't proceeding with reasonable diligence for the other for those other days. So the appellant would disagree with the military judge's conclusion of law that the government was acting with reasonable diligence for those other periods, but still agrees with the military judge that for those 37 days where there was no prosecutorial activity, that is enough to substantiate an Article 10 violation.
Well, there was no prosecutorial activity. Wasn't there substantial activity pointed toward determining who was going to try this thing?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I mean,
not necessarily.
Well, they had coordinated on the 4th of April, 2006, under a memorandum of agreement that the government had used previous times, in fact, had used it in a murder case with no issues. So I agree that the military judge correctly found that any coordination after that, such as the memorandum dated 17 April, was merely a formality, and that as of 4 April, the jurisdiction issue had been resolved. And that's further shown by the fact that once the government got that memorandum, they didn't do anything with it for another month, so they obviously weren't waiting for it.
How do you address the defense delay, request for delay after the 37 days of delay?
I would point to the court that the delay was requested at day 90 of the pretrial confinement, and that the military judge correctly found that when looking at the speedy trial issue, the court just excludes those days of looking at the conduct of the government. However, that should not eviscerate the government's duty under Article 10 to act with reasonable diligence in bringing the accused.
What does it tell us about how does it have anything to say about whether the conditions of confinement were onerous and or whether the appellant was being prejudiced by the delay?
Looking at the fourth prong regarding the prejudice to the appellant, the oppressive pretrial incarceration, the anxiety to the accused, the conditions of the confinement alone would satisfy that prong of the factors under Barker versus Wingo. So she's in an isolation cell.
Right, but then why is the defense requesting the delays to go for vacations and to deal with other cases and so on?
Well, and again, part of the record is that the defense counsel's father died. So it's not that the argument is not that the defense couldn't have gone earlier. They just couldn't have gone at that particular period of time during those 39 days that they requested the delay.
In Ms. Gala, we say that short periods of inactivity are not fatal. I understand. I'm not suggesting 145 days is a short period of time, or even 37 days. What would you say is a short period of time?
I would say that it's relative. It's relative depending upon the conditions. I think that in this case where the conditions are so harsh, 37 days is a very, very long time.
No, I understand that. I'm not trying to get you to concede your case. where would we draw the line? Where should we draw the line? Is that 10 minutes? Is that a day?
I think the speedy trial, I mean, as the Supreme Court has said, the speedy trial right is somewhat slippery, and so you can't put a bright line rule on when Article 10 violation is going to be triggered. So, you know, in United States versus Hatfield, the judge, as this court affirmed, the judge found small periods of time that equated to roughly about 48 days. Small periods of, you know, five different periods of small periods of time was substantial enough to violate.
Counsel, I'm having a hard time hearing you.
Sorry. Yes,
could
Your Honor.
Speak a little louder and speak into the microphone?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why don't you pull the mic a little closer? There you go.
Is this better?
Yes.
Okay. So even in United States versus Hatfield, you had, you know, little chunks of time, five different little chunks of time that in total equated 48 days. And in that case, there was no prejudice and there was no demand for speedy trial.
Is it your view that during those 37 days the government was doing nothing, or that what it was doing was not reasonable and diligent?
They were doing nothing to bring the appellant to trial. There's some evidence that Captain Myers, the trial counsel at the time, had sent some emails regarding pay inquiries and a unit of assignment, none of which are steps towards bringing the accused, Private Thompson, to trial. So during those 37 days, there was no prosecutorial activity in Pellman's case. And that is shown by that the fact that the evidence was all collected by the 7th of April, all the statements were taken by the 7th of April, all the evidence minus a surveillance video, but had been alluded to in an earlier statement by the victim and had been in custody of civilian authorities since the very beginning.
Is that true of the April 3rd offenses as well, the offenses that were discovered on April 3rd?
The sworn statements regarding the blank check and a camera and a laptop, which were eventually not charged, all those statements are dated 7th of April.
So your position is that was complete as well?
That was complete as well. The trial counsel does some interviews afterwards, but doesn't gather any additional information to substantiate the charges. And again, during that 37-day time period, the case was stagnant. The government wasn't processing the appellant's case. The government also put forth that there were military exigencies existing at the time that would have justified the delay.
In that regard, do you take the position that it was an abuse of discretion by the judge to allow testimony of Myers and Brodsky on reconsideration?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why?
Because of the previous hearing, they had an opportunity to present testimony from Captain Myers and Colonel Brodsky, but chose not to. So it was an abuse of discretion for the judge to reconsider
that. That's a recitation of the chronology. What's the legal reason why it's an abuse of discretion?
Again, Your Honor, I would say that because he had already made the decision, he had already ruled on the Article 10 violation.
Under what theory is it an abuse of discretion for a judge to reconsider a decision previously made at trial? In what way was the accused prejudiced by the reconsideration other than in the result?
It provided new testimony that the Army Court relied on, specifically the testimony from Captain Myers and Colonel Brodsky, in overturning the military judge's decision. However, ultimately, the testimony from Captain Myers and from Colonel Brodsky showed that the reasons for the delay were not legitimate. So ultimately, even considering that testimony, the appellant...
So there wasn't any prejudice?
I'm sorry, say again?
So there wasn't any prejudice because the reasons weren't any good?
Well, there was prejudice because ultimately the Army Court sided.
Okay, why don't you go into the reasons then? Your analysis of the reasons that the government gave.
First, they argued that the investigation was not complete. Secondly, they argued that the jurisdiction still needed to be coordinated. How, as stated earlier, it had been coordinated as of 4 April. That was 5 days after Private Thompson went into pretrial confinement. The third reason that the government put forth was regarding military exigencies that existed at the time. First, regarding the heavy caseload that the government had at that time. And secondly, regarding the deployments, or upcoming deployments. However, looking at the caseload issue, the officer and Captain Myers, the trial counselor in this time period, was not so busy that you could not take leave, could not go on TDY. Furthermore, there was no evidence that there was another case of another accused that had a higher priority than private.
Didn't Captain Myers try to get out of that TDY and it was refused?
He asked to stay, but he ultimately was told to go. However, again, there was no evidence that these other cases that he was working on had higher priority than Private Thompson, who was in an isolation cell in Bell County. Turning to the deployment issue that that was raised and that the Army Corps relied on, Private Thompson was put into pretrial confinement on the 31st of March. The deployments don't happen until August. This is four months prior to the deployments. And the only testimony that the government put forth regarding the deployments at this time was that Captain Meyer spent 6 to 8 hours preparing some deployment paperwork for in preparation for the deployment. So not days or weeks. He's not a field training exercise. 6 to 8 hours. So again, I'm not saying that military exigencies cannot be a justifiable reason for a delay, but that they just simply did not exist in this case. Turning to the
not enough time was spent, or deployment is not an exigency.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
Is the problem there that there was the deployment was predictable and was not a exigency, or was the problem that you don't accept the amount of time that went into preparing for the deployment as a valid basis for the delay in this case?
Both. I think that the deployment was so far out that the exigency didn't exist for 4 months, and that secondly, that the time that was devoted for preparation and deployment was minimal.
What is an example of a military exigency that would warrant a trial delay in your case? Without making up, you know, War of the Worlds or something like that.
If the unit was ramping up to deploy in a month, if they were heavily involved in field training exercises.
So you think preparing for deployment is a valid basis to delay a trial?
Under certain circumstances, it could be, yes. Though again, I would say that trial counsel are fungible. So as much as the government could replace the trial counsel that's deploying with another trial counsel, again, it's going to depend upon those circumstances. But in these circumstances, again, those military exigencies just did not exist.
Does the record reflect why appellant was in Bell County Jail as opposed to any other place, including Fort Hood, perhaps?
I have to verify, but I believe it was just that the military prisons didn't have room for Private Thompson. That was my understanding.
Is that in the record, or is that your best guess
response
to the question?
That's my best guess. Like, I verify and check with the record and have it verify that.
No, I'm just asking if the record reflects, and if you don't know, that's fine.
The record does reflect that she was in the isolation cell by no misconduct of her own, that it was a way to...
So you answered my question. You can...
Okay.
On your time, not mine.
Does the record reflect what the staffing of the judge advocate's office was at that time?
Yes, Colonel Brodsky testified that during this time he had about 50 to 70 cases in various stages, and that was spread out amongst the 3 to 4 councils, that each council had about 10 to 12 cases. And again, each of those cases were not all at the court-martial level. They were all in various stages.
Did the testimony indicate that was the normal staffing or that was understaffed?
Colonel Brodsky testified that he was under strength. However, again...
And is that something we can take into consideration, if the office is under strength?
I think that the language in Kossman says that you can balance, you know, the overcrowded dockets and
it's a consideration.
Caseloads of...
It's a consideration that we can look
at. It is a consideration when you look at the totality of everything. But I think based on the circumstances of Private Thompson's confinement, that it should have been they should have put her case in priority, and they failed to do so.
What about the delay in making a request for a speedy trial?
First, I would point out that The request for speedy trial, the demand for speedy trial, it's not a condition precedent to finding a violation, as the Supreme Court has said in Becker versus Wendell, and as this court has applied in United States versus Hatton. And again, this isn't a case where the appellant is raising it for the first time on appeal. She raised it on the same day that she received notice of the referred charges, and the same day that she received the denial of the of her Chapter 10 request. I would say that though a Chapter 10 request, which administrative separation in lieu of a court-martial, is by no means a demand for speedy trial, it's still a request for disposition of her case. And it's still a poke at the government to ask them to dispose of her case and remind them that she's still there. Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time.
You'll have further opportunity on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Major Adam Kazin. I, along with Colonel Norman Allen, represent the United States in this matter. The Army Corps properly overturned military judges' erroneous finding that the government violated the appellant's right to a speedy trial. Viewing this case in the totality, using Barker versus Wingo as the apt structure from Article 10, over the full 140 days, the government exercised reasonable diligence. Now, there was a focus by the military judge on the 37-day period at the beginning of the time period, and it's certainly appropriate when looking at who was responsible for what delay to divide up the time. You know, 37 days accounted to the government, 40 days accounted to the defense. But you don't stop there. In the analysis, then you look in, if there are short periods of delay, whether or not as a prosecution overall, reasonable diligence was exercised.
So is it your position that 37 days of unexplained or unreasonable delay could not amount to a speedy trial violation?
I said that the analysis would stop there, Your Honor, and here's why. It's because by this logic, on day 37, that Article 10 had vested.
I'm asking you a different question, which is an abstraction, not this case, but if all there was in this case was the 37 days, are you saying that's a short enough delay under the Mizgala language that you wouldn't even get into this? That's all I'm asking you.
Theoretically, Your Honor, there is no set time period delay. So theoretically, a 37-day period could be, if no other facts in existence. That's where it
could be adequate to.
It could be, again, on a theoretical level.
I understand your view, and not in this case.
Not
but,
in this case, no, that's the great caveat. The other thing, there's a couple of points, if I can make early, about those 37 days. First, it did not take the government 1 month to do a Chapter 10 request. It took the government 7 days on the first Chapter 10 request and took 10 days on the second Chapter 10 request. So the idea that the government sat on the Chapter 10 for a month is simply not true.
Are you going to catalog what the government was doing with reasonable diligence during those 37 days?
I can certainly list some things, Your Honor. And again, it's not simply on that case. I mean, we have to understand that when you look at Article 10, the courts have said it's a realistic analysis. We all know that not a single trial counsel isn't working on a single case.
Right. But so what were they doing on this case?
Well, the military judge, and I'll start with the military judge, found that the trial counsel could have preferred those charges on 7 April. That's at Joint Appendix 257. That was in the military judge's findings. But as the counsel noted, NPI was still interviewing soldiers on that day. So it's Friday, April 7th. NPI has interviewed those two soldiers. It's certainly not reasonable to say that charges are going to prefer that moment. Particularly when...
So the answer, what were they doing on April 8th through May 14th? The answer was they interviewing somebody on April 7th.
On April 7th, they were interviewing. April 8th and 9th are Saturday and Sunday, Your Honor. I'm not suggesting that they were doing anything on that day. But then if you go to the 10th and 11th of April, Captain Myers is in trial. And this goes to a point of when you talk about priority and that Article 10 cases should have priority. One is Article 10 is not...
You're giving reasons why they didn't take action. And I think the question is, what action did they take?
I'm sorry. I'll back up.
You can get to the explanations and all that once you tell us what they were doing on this case.
So, Your Honor, on 12, Joint Appendix 257, on 12 April, the government, I believe it was Colonel Broski, was speaking to Bell County about the jurisdictional issue. On the 14th, Investigator Lomas and Detective St. John were discussing the case. And at that point, it wasn't entirely clear which way the evidence was going to flow. If the evidence seized by the KPD was going to go to the military, or if the evidence seized by the military was going to go to KPD. And that's in Joint Appendix 262. The Bell County memo was not sent until 17 April. Now, I understand that that's a formality. Some formalities are more important than others, and this was an important formality because there is, in fact, a policy, and it's actually specifically written in Army Regulation 2710 that says that we will not proceed with a court-martial if someone's going to be prosecuted in state court. The Constitution doesn't forbid it, but as a matter of policy and sound policy, we don't do it. So it was certainly reasonable to wait and see. You go to 20 April, it's a Thursday, 20 April 2006, and the defense and the government are discussing a plea deal. That's a Joint Appendix 257. So on 20 April, at that point, they're discussing a plea deal. Now, admittedly, at that point, Captain Myers has to go on. Now, that's in that day period there. Now, Captain Myers is gone from 24 April until 4 May. When he gets back, he assists defense counsel with the only issue defense counsel seemed to have, which was the pay inquiry. And then on 5 May is when the government decides they need to start transferring this case over to a different trial counsel. Captain Myers testified that Joint Appendix 177 and 178 that he was giving the accused file to Captain Dalrymple, and really over from 5 May till 10 May, they were sort of transferring the case over. They were essentially sharing an office. And Joint Appendix 178, Captain Dalrymple met with military police investigators to find out where the investigation was going and moving it along. And then on the official day that sort of Captain Myers, Captain Dalrymple took over the case was the 15th of May. So there's your 37-day period. So it's not nothing. Is it certainly the government's not going to win any awards for processing in that time? No. But at the same time, it is a realistic assessment. There are other things going on. And
in terms of those other things going on, and if I've interrupted an additional point you're going to make in there, please make it. But how does this relate to the deployment and caseload issue? And that is, in this, can we look at this case and look at the government's processing and say, even if this were taking place in a time of peace and prosperity, even if not a model, that this would be the actions that the government was taking here were sufficient to show reasonable progress in moving the case forward? Or is this a case in which the government's prevailing or not prevailing in this case will depend on the relationship between those factors and the deployment slash caseload burdens that the government was facing?
I don't think the deployment is the key, or the pending deployment was the key factor, Honor. It's a factor to be considered.
If we take it off the table, where are we?
The government could still prevail under reasonable diligence standard, assuming there was something else, because the term military exigencies is not required. Military exigencies are certainly important, but ordinary judicial impediments, caseloads, understaffing, which Colonel Brodsky testified to, those are things that can be taken into consideration.
Let's talk about the understaffing. Did the trial counsel in this case bring to the attention of the staff judge advocate or any other superior at the time this was pending that he had too heavy a caseload to give proper attention to this case?
Not immediately, in the sense that he complained to his superiors, Your Honor, but it was really within less than 30 days that a new trial counsel was assigned. I mean, Colonel Brodsky recognized that Captain Myers is going out and someone else is coming in, and so there was that handoff. The problem was Colonel Brodsky testified to this. There was no one else to give. He had three other trial counsel who said were equally as busy, and if he had handed them this case, we would have been the same place with a different trial counsel having similar issues.
And is there any evidence in the record that the staff judge advocate advised his superiors he had an insufficient staff at that time to timely process the cases that were before the unit?
There's nothing in the record specifically that the SGA went sort of to higher headquarters, Your Honor. I would say two points. Colonel Brodsky did note that there were more incoming trial counsel. There was a Captain Rosati that was coming in as well. And part of it is a little bit of an underlap. But the government doesn't necessarily need to say that there is – sometimes there's going to be gaps in coverage. That's where that language in Ms. Gala comes from, of short periods of inactivity. A new trial counsel, who even the military judge acknowledged was diligently moving this case, was assigned within 30 days. It would have been better, certainly could have been better, that that person assigned earlier.
So is the government's theory that this is a gap in coverage case rather than an understaffing due to other responsibilities case?
It's a little bit of both, Your Honor, because there are other responsibilities that go into this. And it also, when we're looking at the Barker factors, you know, we look at that, and even if the government is negligent, if it's considered negligence and the first factor somehow weighs against the government, we don't stop there, and that seems to be where
just focusing on that factor.
Yes, Your Honor. And again, that's where at some point, we, even if we have to, so yes, there was some negligence on the government's part. Negligence is more of a neutral factor, as the Supreme Court has noted. And we look at those in reference to the other factors when we balance and looking at reasonable diligence for purposes of Article 10.
Last question in that regard. Is there any culture or practice in the Army that would create a disincentive for either a trial counsel or a staff judge advocate to go to a superior and say, I need help?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Culture.
Counsel, I have a question about the plea discussions on April 20th. What happened with those, and when did it happen?
Well, not much happened, Your Honor, because at that time the Civilian Defense Council hadn't really appeared yet. There was a discussion of a plea deal. No plea deal was ever entered. What was entered once the Civilian Defense Council, really within 6 days or 7 days of the Civilian Defense Council being brought onto the case, which is 21 April, the first Chapter 10 request came on 29 May. Civilian Defense Council first appeared on 21 May, and the first Chapter 10 request came on 29 May. So it morphed away from a pretrial agreement sort of negotiation to a Chapter 10 negotiation.
And by Chapter 10 negotiation, you mean a separation in lieu of
court? Yeah, Chapter 10, yes, Your Honor, is a discharge in lieu of court-martial. So it's a deal specifically designed to dispose of court-martial charges. And this brings us to the third Barker factor, which is this demand for a speedy trial. It is not as unimportant as both the military judge and appellant would make it sound. In fact, in Barker, the court noted that it was the most important factor. The legitimate desire to have a speedy trial is given great evidentiary weight. That's the term the Supreme Court used in Barker. And basically what the court has said is that you can't really violate someone's right to a speedy trial if they don't really want a speedy trial. So the best way to look at that is what did defense do? And defense bears not the great responsibility that the government does, but the court acknowledged that the defense does bear some responsibility because she has been assigned a defense counsel. That defense counsel is in contact with the government. And the greater the deprivation, again, I'm quoting the Supreme Court here, the greater deprivation, the more likely the accused is to complain.
So would you characterize this as a strategic move on the part of the defense not to make an earlier demand?
Well, that certainly was the military judge's finding, and that was a finding trumpeted by the accused at the Article 62 appeal. The first time around, the accused, and they actually repeated in their brief, but if you look at the Joint Appendix 431 and 32, and also appellant's brief at 17, they state that that finding of a tactical decision was well supported by the evidence. So actually, the government and the defense seem to be in agreement on that. The problem the defense ran into, and I think the reason why they backed off this concept of in the reply brief, was a tactical decision is not a good thing for the defense when assessing an Article 10 violation, because the courts do not really look at stratagems or tactics when filing an Article 10s favorably. Article 10 is a shield, similar to the Sixth Amendment, and not a sword. And so this idea that they could tactically wait or keep silent or not complain and just sort of sit and lie and wait, sort of goes against the principles of Article 10 in the first place.
Well, what weight should we give to the fact that during this period of time the defense was actively seeking other dispositions than going to a general court-martial?
Well, I think the government's not saying that there has to be a formalistic approach to an Article 10, to a speedy trial demand, but simply looking at it that sometimes a speedy trial isn't in the accused's best interest, and what was in her interest, staying in jail a little while longer to get an administrative discharge is a perfectly sound tactical move by defense counsel to make. And we don't disagree with the judge on that, simply how it weighed out. The issue there being they were not seeking a speedy trial, they were seeking an administrative discharge. And we look at something like Ms. Gala and also in Casio, where there were demands for speedy trial very early in the process. We're talking in Ms. Gala, I believe it was day 46, and that was before referral, before the Article 32, before the referral. And he didn't request any delays in that case. And Casio, I believe it was day 26. And so those were cases where that factor weighed into the accused benefit. The issue here is not only did they wait till day 140, but literally, but figuratively, handed the speedy trial demand with one hand and the request for dismissal on speedy trial in the other. And even the military judge did not classify any of the activities of the defense as liberal as possible to be interpreted as a demand for speedy trial. He said that they specifically didn't ask for a speedy trial. They wanted to get an administrative discharge. Another point I would make is looking at the two separate requests for delays in the Article 32 hearing. And it's not just that they requested a delay. It's a lot of the reasons they requested a delay. And even if we sort of move aside the issues about other scheduling and the death of the civilian defense counsel's father, in both Article 32 delay requests, they said they weren't ready for the hearing. So it's July, and they're telling the I.O., in fact, they're practically threatening the I.O., that if he grants this delay and they're not ready, that she's basically being denied counsel. And the language of that is they said that a over-focus on expeditiousness, I believe is the word they use, is an abuse of discretion in light of a reasonable request for a delay. So, again, this all goes towards the, was she in fact denied a speedy trial? Did she in fact want legitimately a speedy trial? And that is given great evidentiary weight in both a Sixth Amendment analysis, but also in an Article 10 analysis.
What was the date that the Civilian Defense Council joined the case? What was the date that the Civilian Defense Council made an appearance in the case or joined the case?
The Civilian Defense Council, this is on Joint Appendix 257, it says he made an appearance on Sunday the 21st of May, Your Honor. And basically, if one would look at a calendar, the entire month of July was wiped out by defense delay. But there was actually even still things going on. The government wasn't just sitting during that month, or it's not clear what even the defense was doing during that month. But when the Article 32 did go, it went quickly. So we have to look at all these other things to see, was it an otherwise active prosecution?
Counsel, can you move to your prejudice argument as to why this was not oppressive pretrial confinement?
Certainly, Your Honor. The prejudice is once again viewed in light of all the other factors, but her confinement conditions, the government's not saying these were the greatest confinement conditions ever. The problem is that, once again, there was nothing from the defense about it. The first time any of this was mentioned was at the hearing.
But that is more of a notice of the conditions. It does not diminish the fact that the conditions were there and existed, well, and arguably were oppressive. It was an isolation cell.
Well, and Your Honor, the evidence was she was in a cell, it was an isolation cell, she had access to books. The problem is that those conditions may affect different people different ways. There's no sort of a per se thing that...
She was in... Wait, describe the cell.
It said an isolation cell, Your Honor.
With no windows, 23 hours a day, right?
I don't know if it was 23 hours a day, Your Honor. I don't have the hours in front of me, but it was an isolation cell. The government is not diminishing that. It's simply saying that, once again, the principle of the greater the deprivation, the more likely to complain. When the accused can say, I'm not getting paid, and the government can fix that, similarly, and she's got a defense counsel. The defense counsel is in communication. If there's a problem with those
who put her in pretrial confinement?
The government did, Your Honor.
And doesn't the government have any responsibility to know the conditions of the pretrial confinement that they placed people in?
Well, it wasn't, and again, this actually came out more after the 62 appeal was over of why she was in that cell. The problem is that...
But doesn't the government have a responsibility to know where they're placing people?
It does, Your Honor. And they knew where she... I'm not saying they didn't know where she was placed. Whether or not it's a problem, as far as the government... If she's in her cell reading a book and not really having any problems with anybody, then it's not... Not only is it not an Article 10 violation, but it's not the sort of mythical Article 13 violation that the judge sort of found.
But a normal pretrial confinee is not in an isolation cell. They are not deprived of radio or television or exercise rights.
Well, she wasn't deprived. They were certainly limited. And part of that had to do with, admittedly, the commingling of pretrial... She was the only female pretrial confinee. She was a unique status at that time. And the government could have and should have maybe done more to make it more pleasant for her. It is pretrial confinement. And at a certain point, the accused can't really dictate what her levels are, but there is a system that even in Article 13 and for cruel and unusual punishment standards, the court sort of looks and says, hey, there's a system for, if there's a problem for making requests and issues. And again, she wasn't being abused, she wasn't being injured, and these deprivations that she had could have been dealt with perhaps at an administrative level. But to say they're oppressive when there was nothing through her attorney about, hey, how simple is it to, if you're going to submit a Chapter 10 request, where you're going to talk about her pay issues, to say, she's also having some problems in confinement. She's all alone, she's lonely, she needs more TV time. The government can fix that on day 21 or 22 or 24 if they know that's a problem. But to only say that's a problem on day 140, agreed, it's still the government's responsibility, but not necessarily to the level of oppressive pretrial incarceration. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Does the Army have standards for pretrial confinement?
There are, Your Honor.
And how does an isolation cell fit into the standards for pretrial confinement?
I'm not sure it's specific. I can cite the regulations generally, Your Honor. I know that they don't necessarily put people in pretrial confinement isolation cells, but there's also within those regulations, you can't mix them with male and female confinees. You can't mix them with post-trial confinees in light of this court's Article 13 jurisprudence. So there may have to be, you know, in these types of cases, it might be better to have a little more focused where she is and what she's doing.
So it's permissible for the government to enter into arrangement with a locality in which, if it's necessary to have separation of pretrial and post-trial confinees, they'll be put in an isolation cell?
It might be necessary at times, Your Honor. There are things, and
who makes the who makes the decision that an isolation cell should take priority over commingling?
Well, I don't know who makes that decision, but certainly looking at this court's Article 13 jurisprudence and how it frowns upon the commingling, greatly upon the commingling of pretrial and post-trial prisoners because of the presumption of an innocence issue, perhaps going too far in that direction in concern of Article 13 one way and not recognizing Article 13 the other or Article 10 the other isn't the smartest policy.
So we'll look in the mirror to figure out that we're the source of the problem.
Not at all, Your Honor. I'm just not trying to put it on the court. I'm simply saying that sometimes these decisions, we focus on some one thing and forget about another.
Understand.
Does the record reflect why she's in Bell County versus somewhere else?
I don't think the record, I would agree with my counsel here that there is no pretrial confinement facility or prison facilities on Fort Hood at all. Whether that's specifically in the record, Your Honor, I don't know. There is an MOU between Bell County and Fort Hood because we don't have those pretrial confinement facilities. I couldn't point you to a record site.
But whether that's in the record or not, fair enough.
Yes, sir.
Counsel, do you know if whether or not the appellant raised the Article 13 issue at the second trial?
She did not. She waived it, Your Honor. And in fact, there was an opportunity, and the government cites this in its brief, there was an opportunity to have a little more discussion about that, about why she was in that, and that's where all this information about her status. And she affirmatively waived it as part of her pretrial agreement. And even the judge, having gotten some more information about it, his only response was, I understand. So I'm not sure where we go from there.
You may take the time to give a brief conclusion.
Thank you, Your Honor. Perhaps the central principle from this case is that an appellant is not permitted to use Article 10 as a tactical weapon. An accused who asserts the right to a speedy trial must legitimately desire a speedy trial and not just desire dismissal of her charges when the administrative discharge doesn't work out. The government acted reasonably in light of all the circumstances in their pursuit of appellant's case, and appellant's claims of prejudice are insufficient to warrant the relief under Article 10. The military judge erred in his analysis, and the Army Corps properly set the record straight by overturning his ruling. And this court should affirm the Army Corps' decision.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Counsel, before you begin, I'd like to ask you whether you can point to any prejudice to the defendant's ability to prepare its case from the 37 days of delay that the military judge talked about in his ruling?
Well, ultimately, the appellant, Private Thompson, did plead guilty. So there is no, while there is no positive evidence, I guess, in the record of trial to show what prejudice there was, I would cite the Supreme Court in Barker versus Wingo when they say that any defendant who's locked up is hindered in their ability to gather evidence, contact witnesses, or otherwise prepare his defense. And I think that an appellant in an isolation cell would be even more so.
And what's your position on the fact that of this court's ability to look at the conditions of the confinement, given that you waived the Article 13 motion?
That was subsequent to the litigation of the Article 10 motion. So I would argue that it should not be considered, even if it is, though. She was waiving it to get the benefit of a pretrial agreement after she's lost her Article 10 motion. And again, it almost cuts against the government's argument because unlike the defendant in United States versus Burge, where they get full credit for their pretrial confinement, appellant does not get the credit for her Article 13 punishment. She's not made whole by the prejudice.
Well, but you waived that. They waived that to get a pretrial agreement.
To get a pretrial agreement, yes, Your Honor.
So you can't complain about it if you got the benefit of your pretrial agreement, can you?
Again, I will just say that she waived it in order to get the pretrial agreement after she's lost her litigation of her Article 10 motion. But that ultimately she didn't get the credit for the Article 13.
What are your two best arguments for why the demand doesn't cut against you, both on the demand factor and the prejudice factor?
One, I think that
you follow.
Yes, Your Honor. Regarding the argument regarding Barker versus Wingo, first of all, when we look at Article 10, as this court has stated, it's more strict, it's more stringent than the Sixth Amendment. So when we look at the four factors, we're looking at through that lens. So even though a case like Barker versus Wingo, there was no violation, that doesn't necessarily mean that those same facts would fall under Article 10. And I think there's a qualitative difference between a defendant, like in Barker versus Wingo, who doesn't object to 13 out of 16 of the government's motions to continue, and he's out on bail, he's a free man, and someone like Appellant Private Thompson, who is trying to negotiate with the government for an alternate disposition with her case, and is in isolation cells, in pretrial confinement. The best argument regarding prejudice, Your Honor, again, just looking at the not only the conditions of her confinement, the nature of her confinement in the 10-by-10 cell and the no contact with the outside world, she's also separated from her daughter, who she sends, her 2-month-old daughter, who she sends to go live with relatives in Louisiana. And I think
that
is also...
But that would suggest she should have been making demands all along. So focus on why the demand doesn't cut against you for that very reason.
As the Supreme Court has stated, that the onus is not on the defendant or on the accused to bring themselves to trial. It's the government's burden to bring the defendant to trial.
Thank you.
I also wanted to highlight that, as the government had said, conceded that there was negligence in this case. As the Supreme Court has said in Dodgett versus United States, negligence, even simple negligence, it still falls on the wrong side of the divide between acceptable and unacceptable reasons for delaying criminal prosecution once it has begun. And that factor should weigh in favor of appellant. I also just wanted to clarify one thing my opposing counsel has argued regarding discrepancy regarding the Chapter 10 request. There were two Chapter 10 requests. The first one was 30 days. Joint Appendix 257, it was submitted on the 29th of May. The Joint Appendix on 267, the convening authority actions, it was received as denied on the 27th of June. And then subsequent Chapter 10 motion took 10 days to process. So I just wanted to clarify that on the record. If there are no further questions, I would just ask that the court dismiss the charges at issue with prejudice and to confirm the trial judge's ruling.
Thank you, counsel, and we thank both counsel for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 10:20 a.m.
All rise.